Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine last week sent hundreds of Ohio National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. ahead of the Biden inauguration on Wednesday. A sizable contingent remained in Columbus to keep the peace. DeWine and Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther at a news conference last week said that city and state offices near the statehouse will remain closed through Wednesday and advised downtown workers to stay home. Downtown businesses boarded up windows and hoped for the best. And the governor called for unity.
It's time for us to observe the peaceful transfer of power and to remind ourselves of what brings us together, binds us together, holds us together as Americans. Our love for freedom, our love for liberty, our love for our Constitution.
Columbus Police Chief Tom Quinlan is with us. Welcome back to the show, Chief.
Good morning, Ann. It's very nice being with you again.
Yesterday's armed protests really never much materialized into the violent mob that was feared by some. What impact do you think the numbers of law enforcement had on the turnout?
Well, first, I'd like to thank the community for heeding our call to avoid downtown if possible. I think that certainly they did their part in making yesterday a successful event. Law enforcement, again, it's always been our goal to be over-prepared and underwhelmed, and I think that's what you saw yesterday in the way everything resulted in just a peaceful protest.
So law enforcement remains on alert, a high alert, I guess. Why is that?
Well, again, the window of opportunity for someone to engage in disrupting the peaceful transfer of power remains open. So while we're pleased that yesterday went very well, I think the real challenge will, again, remain Wednesday during the inauguration. And we want to maintain a presence, a visible presence, and maintain safety for our community and do our part along with the other 50 states that are experiencing likely protests as well.
The state law allows protesters to carry weapons on the grounds of the statehouse, but not inside the statehouse. A number of protesters carried rifles. What directive do you give officers if things turn violent under those circumstances?
It's very complicated. Everyone has a right to defend themselves, including officers. What we're watching for is that people are legally and lawfully carrying the weapons in a non-provocative manner. If someone would bear the arm in a way that's provocative or as an imminent attack on someone, then officers are certainly going to respond appropriately. We have a lot of resources, not just force on force, but there are other means we can de-escalate before we'd even get to that point to isolate people, barricade them off from other parts of the group and take action.
There's been criticism that police use of force differs when protesters are white. Mayor Ginther said that police would not use chemical agents on peaceful protesters. Police did use chemical agents on Black Lives Matter protesters this summer. Can you explain to us what the distinction is there and why the change of heart?
Sure. So what police are responding to are actions, not the speech. So while people may be peacefully protesting, whether it be over the summer or in the last few days, what we're looking for is people who are engaged in activities that are putting other people safety at jeopardy, surrounding cars, damaging property, putting lives at risk. That's where we step in with these lower levels of force, again, to be able to disperse crowds who may have a lot of good people there, but there are bad actors in that crowd. And we have to do the right level of response to maintain the peace and order so people who are exercising their constitutional rights have a safe platform to do so.
Right. But, people like elected officials were, sprayed with a chemical agent last summer. They weren't doing anything wrong at the time. Why is the mayor saying that the police would not use chemical agents in peaceful protests? What if something happens? I mean, who decides?
Well, again, it's the officers that are present follow the directions of the law enforcement leaders, what we call incident commanders. They're the ones that will give that direction. And again, it's not about whether the group collectively is not engaged in any type of violent or illegal activity. It's if there are people in the crowd that are creating an unsafe environment for others, that's where we need to take action to disperse that, the bad actors, so we can reestablish a safe zone for people who want to exercise their rights lawfully. And that's what our goal is, and that's how we respond to these events.
What policy changes has the department made, or have the department made, as a result of the lessons from the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer?
Well, we certainly changed our policies on being readily identifiable, found other ways to get body camera footage or video of the interactions, and how we will discuss what we're seeing on the video camera, so it's easier to complete an arrest report later. Certainly looking at how we use bikes and other resources to try to create more of a de-escalation and prevent something from escalating to the point where we would have to respond with chemical irritants or other levels of force. Our goal is to get compliance through our presence and our directions.
Officers were instructed to have their body worn cameras turned on yesterday. How has the department reinforced the use of body cameras after the failure to use it in the Andre Hill fatal shooting by Officer Adam Coy?
So very good question. One of the things we've done is tried to balance the amount of storage and the battery life on versus the access to having the footage that we want. So what we've done is made some changes to where now once an officer is dispatched to an area, they'll automatically activate their camera, even including drive time. That takes the, you know, when you get to scene and something happens really fast, you that may be the last thing on your mind about activating your camera. This lets you do it while you're driving to the scene. And we are going to eat up more storage space and reduce the battery life, but we have a better chance of getting things on tape that we want to have on tape. So those are some of the plans that we put in place.
I mean, can't you just, I mean, if nothing happens during the incident, can't you just dump the footage?
No, it's not into the cloud immediately. Okay. It has to go back to the server and be uploaded to a server so the memory in the camera can fail, you know, can get filled up, and so can the battery die. So we're looking for, we have about $3.2 million this year to purchase new equipment in the budget that will be cloud-based, and things will go right to the cloud. It can be live streamed. We'll have automatic triggers, so we'll be able to have a lot more robust response. Plus, we'll have replaceable batteries.
Okay. You recommended that Officer Coy be fired. The union, the Fraternal Order of Police, has filed a grievance saying that the firing violated the union contract. What's the latest on that?
Well, it's my understanding the grievance they filed is more about a due process argument on to preserve timelines. I don't know that they have the intention of arbitrating the termination until the outcome of the criminal case is done.
Okay.
But we do have a contractual time limit they have to file, and they're just preserving timelines. That's my understanding.
And have other officers been disciplined in that case?
No, there's currently numerous officers under investigation by Internal Affairs to determine if any other policies were violated, and they will be, once that's done, we'll take the appropriate action.
It's been a rough start to the new year, 14 homicides so far, or is it 12, and two bodies discovered. What is your sense about what's driving this trend at this point? I know it doesn't go by a calendar year when it comes to killing people.
No, I think the common thread here is gun violence and people's willingness to use guns and lack of accountability when we do arrest people and they have a gun charge and they're continue to not face any consequence after that. I think the guns, access to guns, we just saw a child shoot his sister accidentally because of an unsecured weapon in the home. If we could at least make an impact on securing weapons in the home to prevent accidental shootings and suicides, that would lower the number right there. So, I mean, that's something we're working on with the community every day.
Chief Quinlan, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne. I appreciate your time today.
That's Columbus Police Chief Tom Quinlan. We are going to get to our weekly reporter roundtable now. So I want to introduce the folks. Reporter Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, Ann.
And also Associated Press Statehouse correspondent Julie Carr-Smythe. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning, Ann.
And NBC4 Statehouse reporter Adrian Robbins joins our reporter roundtable rotation. Welcome, Adrian.
Thank you so much, Ann.
The governor and Mayor Andrew Ginther held a press conference with law enforcement from the city, Ohio Highway Patrol, and National Guard last week. Adrian, what is your sense about the level of state prep versus what we saw at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th?
Well, and I don't even think that you can really compare the two. And that could be because obviously there was that show of force from not only the Ohio National Guard, but the Ohio State Highway Patrol. They were prepared for just about anything. And, you know, they told us last week that they wanted to be overprepared and underwhelmed. And I think what we saw on Sunday is that's exactly what happened. But as Chief Quinlan was saying, there's still a couple days left. And so I think they're going to stay on guard for that.
Any sense? I mean, do any of you hear any get any inkling of what's to come over the next couple days, Julie?
Yeah, I can say that AP has some new reporting out today that they are actually screening guard members themselves to assure there isn't some sort of internal effort to turn these troops, if you will, against Joe Biden's inauguration. So, you know, much like what happened Sunday, I think that they don't know for sure what to expect. And so they're trying to cover every angle.
So the point being that they think that a lot of the insurgency could be being nurtured within the military.
Well, certainly there's some evidence that there were trained military and trained police at that uprising, if you want to call it, that insurrection. And so as every state capital and Washington are calling in the National Guard, they're just doing hyper screening to make sure that there aren't any bad actors inside the organization who might be trying to do unsafe things.
What do you know?
At the inauguration,
Andy Chow.
Well, I was going to say I'm sorry if I missed Julie or Adrian saying this already, but this is something that happened that we saw last summer in the summer of 2020 during the George Floyd demonstrations, the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, where a member of the Ohio National Guard was sent to Washington, D.C. for some of that deployment. And it had been discovered that this member had been posting things on social media that appeared to be supporting white supremacy. And so they pulled that person off the deployment and brought them back. And so I think what the AP is reporting is just sort of like doubling down on that investigation, that behavior.
Yeah, kind of like the fox guard in the hen house, Adrian.
It does kind of seem that way, but it is interesting that this is something that they ran into, like Andy brought up, last summer. And it was something that at the time, General Harris said that they were going to really start looking into in the Ohio National Guard. So it would be interesting to see how far that investigation has gone, especially with what we're seeing now.
Guns are allowed outside the statehouse, but not inside the statehouse. State officials said that they're not going to reconsider that policy. I suppose it is until something happens. But any sense about the calculations on that, you guys? Andy?
We've seen it for the past couple of years now. We've seen several open carry protests at the State House, and it's something that you hear a lot of gun rights groups saying that this is among the rights that they want protected, is for them to be able to open carry and to show publicly that they have a right to own and bear arms. And so it's just kind of worth noting that, yes, we've seen we saw the violent insurrection on January 6th, but we have seen a lot of open carry rallies and demonstrations at the State House for the past few years now. But then to your point, Anne, it is sort of like this sort of situation that could boil over at some point, and who knows when and where or how or if ever. And it sort of goes back to what Chief Quinlan was saying, is that These people in law enforcement and the Ohio National Guard have become pretty accustomed to seeing people open carry, seeing these long rifles on the state house grounds. And so what they're looking for is some sort of provocation where they're not holding it the way that they're trained to hold it. They're not holding it with the barrels down. Maybe somebody's finger is hovering the trigger. Those are the things that they're looking for now, because you have to kind of train your brain to say, okay, I see a rifle. That's not necessarily what should be considered dangerous at this point. You have to go to the next step after that.
Mm. Yeah, Julie?
Right, and I do think in terms of rethinking that gun policy, I mean, it's just, it's really not going to happen here in Ohio. I think the politics of this are that the Republican Party is in control at every level, and they are pro-Second Amendment. We've seen them even continue to pass pro-Second Amendment legislation, even in the face of violence, continually. I mean, it's been happening since, you know, it's a regular thing at our state house and with our governors. You know, we do have this effort on the part of Governor DeWine to dial back some of that. They call these common sense changes that would, they're really the low-hanging fruit of, you know, background checks and other and closing loopholes and that kind of thing. And, you know, he hasn't been able to get the traction for that. The reason, you know, people see a lot of irony in the fact that these guns can't come into the state house where the lawmakers are who are passing these laws for the rest of us that are loosening some of the restrictions on guns.
Adrian, some people thought that the governor would not either just let the law go into effect without his signature or veto the law, the Stand Your Ground law that just went into, I don't know if it's gone into effect yet, but it was just signed. I don't think it had an emergency clause. So people thought he wouldn't back that bill because he still hasn't been able to get his package through.
Yeah, I mean, I personally was surprised when he did sign that bill. I thought he would either, one, veto it, or again, just let it go into effect without his signature. But I think what we're seeing and what a lot of people guess we are seeing is Governor DeWine does have an election coming up. And he has been criticized by the Republican Party quite a bit this past year. And he was especially criticized by Republican lawmakers for not going forward with something like Stand Your Ground. And Governor DeWine talked about that this was a promise he had made when he first took office, and that's why he ultimately did sign it. But I know a lot of people were disappointed. They felt like this was a bargaining chip he could have used to get his package through, and then he didn't. But he did say he's going to persist in trying to get that legislation package that was created after, obviously, the tragedy in Dayton through. You know, he said it's not done yet. But yeah, it's interesting. When you look at, you are allowed to open carry outside the Ohio State House, like Julie and Andy said, I think when you look at the makeup of our General Assembly, that was never going to be something that changed. And it was interesting. I did talk to a protester on Sunday who approached me who had a rifle with him. And he said, you know, this is really about unity. We're trying to support everyone coming together. And so I asked him, why do you feel the need to carry a rifle? Does that support unity? Does that support peacefulness? And he said, this amendment right protects my First Amendment right. And that was kind of the idea that some of these guys had, is that they carry the rifle to somehow tie it to their First Amendment right. And so I think that there would be a lot of pushback from these people if you did decide to start limiting open carry at the state house.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's NBC4 Statehouse reporter Adrienne Robbins. Also with us is Associated Press Statehouse correspondent Julie Carr-Smythe and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, and Adrian Robbins of NBC4. All right, so Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost asked a judge last week to block $102 million in special fees that First Energy was about to start collecting. What's the latest there? I mean, is this what we think of as the money that comes out of utility bills?
Not quite.
Okay.
The court had already blocked the so-called bailout money, the fees that were going to help with those two nuclear plants.
Gotcha.
And so Yost went back and said, we also want you to block this thing that was part of a sort of an arcane section called decoupling. And what it does is it decouples the company's profits from how much electricity it sells. So the idea in theory is that, and this has been the case with other utilities, the idea in theory is, you know, you want your electricity companies to be stable, and you're also trying to encourage them to shift over to renewable sources, to get people to use less energy. So how do you maintain stability for the markets and for the customers and for the company? But in this particular bill, the tainted House Bill 6, they had guaranteed First Energy profits at 2018 levels, which are the highest they've had in recent memory because of a hot summer and some other reasons. And so Yost went in and said, you know, we really have to get rid of this decoupling provision and let customers keep that money.
Andy?
That's a great explanation. It's just another provision that was attached to HB 6 that is now called into question because of what role First Energy may have played in this alleged bribery racketeering scheme. And so when people are looking at this federal investigation, wondering how did HB 6 become law, and if there really was indeed this bad intent behind it all, then you have other officials like Attorney General Dave Yost looking into how First Energy is profiting from all this, how First Energy is benefiting from all of this. And so what we saw with, and I think you mentioned it earlier, the Franklin County court case and the Ohio Supreme Court cases issuing injunctions to stop new charges from appearing on everybody's bills this month. We saw that. So we saw that block. And this is just another attempt to take a look at another funding mechanism that would benefit First Energy as the federal investigation continues into what really happened.
So these blocks by the Franklin County Court and the Ohio Supreme Court, how long? I mean, so they're blocking this funding that's, let me step back a second. The $102 million in special fees, was that called for from House Bill 6?
Yes.
Okay. And so all of these fees and so forth that have been blocked at this point, blocked until when? The Ohio General Assembly, who knows? I mean, they're under no obligation to do anything. Adrian Robbins, do you know?
I mean, that's the biggest question, is it seems like everyone is dealing with these issues surrounding House Bill 6, but we still haven't seen that repeal. And I'd be interested to hear what Julie and Andy think. But, you know, back in the summer, it felt like a done deal that House Bill 6 would be repealed in some way or another, repealed or replaced, or there were several different mechanisms going on in opinions. But it was really a bipartisan push from everyone, including Governor Mike DeWine, who said this bill needs to go. And it hasn't yet. They haven't dealt with it in the legislative channel, at least. It seems like we've gone through the courts, the Attorney General's gotten involved, but the General Assembly still needs to act and figure out what they're going to do moving forward.
So
I think that these are temporary stays in both cases at this point, but that the next step in that would be to make those permanent. So, you know, the company would appeal, then depending on how that goes, that could either be permanent and it doesn't. And I don't know that that is decided yet.
Yeah, what you have right now is you have different attempts going on. You have people in the legislature who want to repeal HB 6. But then you have other critics and opponents of HB 6 who were looking at the tea leaves in late 2020 and saying, well, they're not going to do it. They say that they're going to do it, but they're not going to do it. So they started taking judicial action, court action to sort of stop it through the court process. And that's where you see the cities like Columbus and Cincinnati taking it to court. That's where you see Attorney General Dave Yost taking it to court. And so that's why we have these court cases now issuing preliminary injunctions, because the long game here is that these lawsuits are looking to basically repeal HB 6 or to wipe out the portions of HB 6 that they believe to be wrong because of the allegations that are made in federal court. So it's kind of this trickle down thing. You've got the federal Department of Justice carrying out their investigation with a court case coming. And then you have these other court cases arguing that because of this, I'm making hand motions, even though everybody on the radio can't see what I'm doing.
I can see you.
you've got the court cases sort of pending what happens in federal court. And then you have the legislature, who you have plenty of people saying that they want to see a repeal or a partial repeal or a delay, yet they're not doing anything at this point.
Whew. Okay. Well, that's the ongoing saga story, along with about a few others, including, I won't get to it when I get to it. DeWine, the governor was asked some tough questions last week about why Ohio lags behind surrounding states in vaccinating residents. The CDC shows Ohio has 900,000 vaccine doses, but 435,000 and some change of people have received them. Is this poor planning, a lack of staffing? Adrian Robbins, how is the governor explaining this?
Yeah, you know, the governor did face some tough questions because Ohio is a state that is lagging behind several others. But many states, again, are seeing these kinds of lags. And the governor has basically said, look, we did put the planning in place. We have been trying, because I think several reporters in a roundabout way were asking him, what have you been doing? What is the planning in place? Is this really the plan that we've spent all this time on? And the governor has tried to explain that, you know, there are several different factors of why we are lagging, but it will be interesting to see, you know, how quick we really do move forward, especially he does have some lofty goals as far as getting kids back into school by March 1st. You know, that's getting closer and closer, and getting those teachers and school personnel vaccinated. And obviously, even before that, we're starting with our elderly population and seeing how quickly we're able to move through them as well.
Columbus Public Health came under fire last week, Julie, when a local CEO line jumped ahead of teachers and others. Dr. Myshika Roberts called it a misstep. The Ohio Department of Health issued guidance on how to handle surpluses. But number one, does anybody know who the CEO is?
I don't, but I would say that, you know, this is part of the problem. And my understanding of some of the jump ahead issues, not particularly this one, but generally, is like it's the handling issues and the nature of the vaccine having to be kept very cold or frozen until it's used, sometimes is creating this situation where if you don't get enough people in line, if you don't have a system that's getting them in line quickly enough, and you don't want it to get wasted, that you're sometimes vaccinating people who aren't the priority, just to use it so it doesn't go to waste. And I mean, it's we've seen governors in other states who are just complaining about the flow of it and the planning at the federal level, not being exactly helpful in that regard either.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah. So what we've seen is, and this is just such a sad story that happened at a nursing home where it had requested a certain amount of vaccines and then it overestimated. And so they all of the sudden had a bunch of extra vaccines to administer and time was running out for them to actually administer it. And so they had to actually throw out some of the vaccine because they weren't able to put it in as many arms as they could. And so now what groups are supposed to do is sort of create, I've heard it called a spoilage list, create a list where, okay, you're gonna ask for a certain amount of vaccine. And you're going to have the people that you assume are going to show up to get that vaccine, and we're going to ship it to you. Now, from that time, if we ship you that amount of vaccine and it turns out the number that you estimated is actually lower, then you need to have a list ready of people that you are going to get the vaccine to in a timely manner so it doesn't spoil, so it doesn't expire.
But does
so
that, that but does that standby list still have to fulfill the, you know, the requirements of you know, age or or whatever is putting people in line in the first place?
Well, this is where government planning, really has to sweep in here. I mean, at some point there has to be either some master list from top to bottom that is then disseminated by state or by institution, or, you know, there has to be some other way to make sure that, you know, the backup list is there and at the right place and that the person knows they're on a backup list. And, you know, I wouldn't pretend to know how to do it, but that's what government's for.
Adrian, did you want
to? You know, that's part of something interesting, though, too. And maybe that is where some of this line jumping is happening or could be happening is early on, people asked about that, you know, how much oversight is being done by the government when it comes to who exactly is getting these vaccines and who's making sure that they check all the correct boxes. And, you know, Governor DeWine had said at the time they didn't want to be big brother on this because it will slow down the process. So unfortunately, it's kind of the give and take of, you don't want to be micromanaging some of these people. At the same time, that's when we could end up with some people who maybe it's not their time to get the vaccine, but they know the right person and are getting it. But again, and also with the amount of vaccines that we're seeing being wasted as well. And it's something that early on Governor DeWine had said they didn't want to micromanage because it slows things down, but now we're seeing mistakes being made as well.
He said, the governor said last week that the president-elect his administration has contacted him about what he needs for the vaccine. Did he suggest any changes coming with the Biden administration, Andy Chow?
Yeah, I asked about that last week too, because I think people will know this, that the Governor DeWine and his administration has been very hesitant to assign any blame or criticism to the Trump administration for all sorts of things, of course, but especially when it comes to the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so I just sort of asked, what are the issues you're seeing from the federal level that are tripping us up here on the state and local level? And then what would he like to see done differently by the Biden administration? And he sort of, you know, didn't really answer the question directly, but he did mention that part of the issue here is that, and we're going to see it in the coming days here, that there are providers in Ohio who have now been assigned to administer the vaccine. And those providers are able to sign people up to get the vaccine. But what they don't know until a day in advance is when they'll get that shipment. So providers are on standby right now, and they don't really know when they're going to get it. They could be told that they're going to get it Wednesday, and so they can start administering on Thursday. But they just don't know. And then that just sort of hurts the communication pipeline from the top to the bottom. So people who are on this list, they don't know exactly when they can get it.
We are going to take a quick break. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press and Adrian Robbins of NBC4, where she is a State House reporter. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Adrian Robbins, State House reporter for NBC4 in Columbus, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Summit County Councilwoman Liz Walters is the new leader of the Ohio Democratic Party. Now both parties are led by women. Republicans reelected Jane Timken. U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown back Walters. Why? I mean, what was his, why Walters? Julie Carr Smythe?
I think that Walters has made a nod to the Black legislative caucus, as well as the Young Black Democrats, to try to diversify the party. She's seen as a young and energetic. She also comes from, she comes from Akron, the same place as Jane Timken. And so I think that, it'll be interesting to see how the two of them go at it together. And that's also First Energy territory, which is an interesting twist because it's a big mover and shaker there.
Go ahead, Andy Chow.
I was going to say that, when David Pepper, the former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, stepped down, when you heard other top Democratic officials like Sherrod Brown talk about what they want to see the future of the party look like, part of the call to action there was to start doing a better job at reaching out to more of Ohio. You're seeing Democrats do really well picking up votes in these urban areas, but it seems like when it comes to statewide races, you can't just rely on the big urban eight cities to carry you through. And when you do get out to more rural but still small city areas like Chillicothe, you don't really see much support at all for Democrats. And so you're hearing people like Sherrod Brown, who historically has polled well and done well in elections with those areas of Ohio, wanting to see a better showing in those areas for Democrats.
I guess the idea is that he's proof that you can do it.
Yeah.
Some people, Adrian, say they want a Stacey Abrams type figure at the helm of the Democratic Party in Ohio. They have the same sort of hurdles to overcome at this point as Democrats in Georgia did for many years.
Yeah, I think 2020 was a disappointing election for Democrats, obviously. A lot of them had thought that Ohio is certainly the swing state that it's always been, and that's not what was shown this past year. And obviously, we'll see what happens in the next couple of years. But it was a sad morning, that morning after the election for Democrats. And so I think they're pushing for maybe a bigger change than they previously thought that they would need, and a big change and a big swing like what we saw in Georgia. So they're absolutely looking for that kind of energetic younger voice that's going to diversify the party, and like Andy said, hopefully pick up votes in other places that they don't necessarily see those votes coming in, especially in the statewide races where they have only been successful with Senator Brown, obviously.
Right. I mean, it's been called a swing state because Ohioans kind of split down the middle between Democrats and Republicans, Julie Garth-Smith. But because the state's so gerrymandered, Republicans dominate in the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate and in Congress as well.
That's right. And AP actually did quite a detailed analysis of this in 2018 and found, the Republicans are getting they have more seats than they should based on the number of votes. That's kind of an obvious thing, but when you neutralize the district lines and take a look at the voting across the board, it is pretty even. But our maps are able to support very far right candidates such as Jim Jordan out in the western part of the state, who led the Republicans' push against the impeachment last week, and who is very well supported there. People like Anthony Gonzalez, are more moderate and get pushback. So, redistricting will be a huge piece of this in 2021 to try to figure out how you create maps that both parties can agree on.
And if they can't agree, what happens, Andy?
Oh, there's a whole process there. There is, because of reforms that Ohioans voted on in 2015 and 2018, the process has to be approved on a bipartisan measure. So the congressional maps are created by the state legislature, and then the state legislature has to approve it with a 60% majority and with bipartisan support. But if they can't do it, then it goes to the Ohio Redistricting Commission, which is made up of the Ohio governor, the secretary of state, the auditor, and then members of the Senate and House, Republicans and Democrats, and once again, requiring bipartisan support. And then there are other rules there too. To your question, and if they constantly get to a stalemate, then they can either pass a shorter term 4-year map, and then it can also go all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court. So there's all sorts of rules and systems in place to get a map that a lot of people think will be more fair than in the past.
And a lot of people would say, well, why not just have shorter term ones? Why do you have them for 10 years? Obviously, it's based on the census, but there's an argument. What the parties don't like about that is they can't plan.
That's right. Yeah, you want to have a 10-year map because, right, you have to be able to see. I mean, this it depends on what it dictates, what where people live and who's next in line. And I mean, for political parties, I mean, they're planning for 8 years. You know, people are getting in line and finding their path to various higher offices every day. And they play the long game. Most politicians do.
The 2020 census, the results of that census come out in February. Is there any sense that there's any problems with the count in Ohio? Do any of you guys know that? Adrian?
I think that this map will be interesting. This count will be interesting, and ultimately then the map will be interesting, because obviously with the census, they were dealing with the pandemic just like everyone else. And there was a big concern that there would be an undercount. And I know Ohio is one of the states that they are concerned could ultimately lose a congressional seat this year.
Right. Let's see. Back in the Ohio Senate, the new president, Matt Huffman, released the 16 standing committees for this session, which is certainly in the weeds for most people. But does it tell us anything larger about legislative priorities? Who's in charge? Andy, Julie, any of you? Adrian?
No. I think that a lot of the people who have been in leadership in the past remain in leadership. Okay. There wasn't too much of a huge shakeup. You do see people like, I believe, and I might be wrong here, but I believe Republican Senator Andrew Brenner is now the chair of the Education Committee, a committee that Senator Peggy Lehner had chaired for a really long time. And she was really sort of the guardrail to a lot of more conservative issues coming through the committee. She wanted to bring more, she brought more of a moderate voice to the Senate Education Committee, even though she was a Republican. Mm-hmm. So we do see a couple of different leadership changes there that could make a difference.
And Senator Brenner is a conservative.
Yes. Yeah. And so I think what we're going to see here is, I think the bigger thing here is that things are still weird. It's just so weird because of COVID-19 and the pandemic and you know, the things that you usually see around this time, we're not seeing.
Here's something kind of weird. The Senate president named his cousin and fellow Republican, State Senator Steve Huffman of Tip City, to chair the health committee. He's a physician, so in a sense that makes sense, but he lost his job as an ER physician last year because of comments he made about hand washing and people of color. Adrian Robbins, what about that?
Yeah, you know, you brought up, it is obviously Senate President Matt Huffman's cousin, so in that way, I guess it's not that surprising, and he is a physician, but there has been already some pushback on this appointment because of his previous racially insensitive comments during talks about the coronavirus, and so it'll be interesting if he previously kind of just came out and had a statement about his comments, walking them back. But it'll be interesting to see if he responds to some of this criticism and maybe tries to make a point to make people feel comfortable with his appointment as chair of this committee, or if they try to move on and not address this. But it's definitely something people are taking note of and a lot of people aren't happy to see.
Yeah. Julie?
Yeah, I think that there was a question at the time about whether Steve Huffman should resign over this because it was considered inappropriate. We were in the midst of the Black Lives Matter reckoning in the country, kind of. And, you know, he did apologize and try to explain what he was saying at the time and that he didn't mean it, that it was just inartfully put. And so, you know, we'll see how that goes. That's a really important committee for Republicans because that's where all of the virus stuff will be going. But also that's where the abortion bills are usually heard and lots of other things that they care about. And you know, Huffman wants to have an ally there. I will say that I went and spoke to the Senate Republican caucus last week. We had a media panel, and you know, the new Senate president was very welcoming of the press and talk. And
were you surprised?
Yeah, we had a very open discussion about what, you know, how we feel about things and how they feel about things. And I think that that the nice sort of olive branch at a time when we've come through some real attacks on the press by a Republican president.
Now I'm going to bring up that perennial question I have. This, Andy, the state needs to repay millions in federal loans it used to pay unemployment benefits during the pandemic. Interest hasn't kicked in yet, but where's the state going to find the money? Not only for that, but everything else is coming up. But for that, the unemployment rate's not going to go down appreciably anytime soon.
Right. Yeah. So the way they pay off that interest is just through higher fees for the employers. And like you said, Ann, this is something we've talked about over and over again, the idea of reforming the unemployment compensation system. And so what we saw is that the state was heading towards a cliff to begin with. And then with COVID-19, it was just a giant mountain instead. A lot of experts saying that the recession, the economic fallout of COVID-19 was so big that even a reform to the unemployment compensation wouldn't have fixed it. But yes, the state is still looking at a system that remains to be insolvent and is paying out a lot and has had a lot of federal aid, federal funding coming in to help out. But it's still an issue that the state faces. And if whether legislators want to address it or not is still a question that's up in the air.
Yeah, it took years to pay off the debt the last time after the recession, right, Julie?
Yes. And, you know, there was sort of this question of whether it was $5 billion or $8 billion that was left on John Kasich's desk when he got into office after that recession. Mm-hmm. You know, creative ways have been used in the state, whether it's, you know, sort of monetizing the tobacco profits or the thruway or some other thing or the turnpike in order to try to find money here and there for stuff. You know, I'm sure there's some hope out of Washington that because Biden has talked about this relief package to states and, you know, maybe that's a way that they're going to try to plug holes in state budgets across the country.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask each of you, what are you looking forward to this week, Adrienne Robbins?
I think everyone's kind of looking towards Wednesday, whether it be from a security standpoint or from what, you know, our leaders end up ultimately saying once Joe Biden is obviously inaugurated as the president. But I think Wednesday's the day, whether it be, again, if we see more protest between now and then, if we see people, you know, slowly accepting these election results, which some people have refused to accept to this point. But it'll be interesting. It'll also be interesting. We're already kind of hearing some of the things that future President Biden will be doing in his first couple days of office and what President Trump will do in his final days. Hmm.
Julie Carr Smythe.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, the president has a number of ways that he could end this on an up note, if you will. I mean, he has an opportunity to give a farewell speech, which would be an interesting thing for him. He has an opportunity to leave one of these notes that presidents have historically left in the desk with well wishes for Biden, which would be a nice piece of PR for Trump at a really low point. You know, whether he's thinking in that way or whether he's just packing his boxes and taking off will be what I'm watching for.
Just about 30 seconds, Andy Chow. Yeah.
Well, I'd echo everything that Adrienne and Julie said when it comes to the transition of power. But to add something else, I'll just say that we're looking at the rollout of Ohio's Group 1B plan for the vaccine, where more people are going to be eligible to get it. It's going to be very interesting to see how that distribution infrastructure works and if it does work.
Thanks to you, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press, thanks for your time as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Adrienne Robbins, State House reporter for NBC4. Welcome to the show. Appreciate your time as well.
Happy to be here.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.